Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents North America's Forgotten Past by W. Michael Gear and Kathleen O'Neill Gear. Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Elizabeth Jernigan, Bradley Smith, Gregory Gordon, Michael Glenn, Nick DePinto, Scott McCormick, Ren Casey, Daniel Sontag, Alyssa Wilmoth, Larissa Gallagher, David Coyne, Tracy Oliveira, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Keegan, Michael John Casey, Terrence Aselford, Joe Brack, Patrick Busink, Ken Jackson, Gary Tells, Richard Rowan, and Margie Tompros. Book 5, People of the Sea, Part 1.
Not much had changed in the last century, Mary Crowdog decided as she studied the bland conference room in the Bureau of Land Management District office. Just like all the others she'd been in, it had a 12-foot-long table with 20 chairs arranged neatly around the sides, big windows on the northern wall, and a coffee pot that smelled as if it had been sitting on the burner for 3 days straight. A large map representing Southern California hung on the wall. A century ago, they would have had a map, too, hand-drawn and smudged with dirt and grease. But the faces of the government officials would have looked a great deal like the ones she now saw. Smugly superior, thinly masked by a professional artificial pleasantness. As Mary opened her file, still more BLM personnel filtered into the room. From the way they acted, their eyes darting uneasily, she had the feeling that the decision had already been made, as it had been in the old days. This meeting, like so many others, was for form only.
Patience, Mary. Endure. Maybe you're wrong.
Mary reached down, smoothing the brown twill skirt she'd chosen to wear. A beaded buckle snugged the tooled leather belt and emphasized her slim waist. She struggled to keep that waist as small now as it had been when she danced competition in the powwows. Mary steeled herself, drawing from power, from the strength that ran in her blood and the blood of her people. It wasn't something that could be explained to a white guy. Power lived in everything, but its roots lay in the past. Maybe that was why the site they'd recently discovered was so important. Its remains were a link to the past, to a time when the power carried in Indian DNA had been strong and had pervaded everything in the world. Mary's grandmother was a revered medicine woman, a healer. But the thread that had passed to Mary was faint. She prayed it would carry her through this government meeting. She knew most of the BLMers who had come. Wesley Keene, the district manager, had settled across from her. He wore synthetic stretch pants, a white dress shirt with a bland tie, and had a pocket full of pens. She'd come to understand Keene. Like most district managers within the BLM, he'd been promoted because he was a nice guy, a team player, not because he was particularly bright or efficient. The district archaeologist, Jack Riddler, sat at Keene's right and avoided Mary's eyes. She'd been told that 85% of the people in the BLM were grossly incompetent, and that the 15% who really cared actually made the Bureau function, such as it did. If so, Riddler headed the class of the 85%. Mel Adams, the engineer, and a couple of the others filled in the flanking chairs. Mel Adams carried a quick-draw calculator on his belt and wore a yellow polo shirt, brown duck pants with slit pockets, and scuffed brown loafers. He deposited a pile of rolled-up maps, blue lines, and surveyor's plats on the table before him. The rest of the participants looked the way BLM employees generally did, attired in basic Banana Republic. All seemed normal, except for the two men who seated themselves to Keene's left. The look of them stirred Mary's premonition of trouble. Keene's unease was reflected in the way he moved his hands like nervous spiders across the tabletop, continually looking through the papers before him. His posture indicated complete deference to the white-haired, medium-framed man who lounged in the chair to his left, and to the dandy sitting to that man's left. Mary studied the white hair. He appeared 50-ish, health spa fit, and suitably at ease on this trip to the field. Capable blue eyes dominated his face. She pegged him immediately. Career bureaucrat. And to his left sat the dandy. Mary immediately cataloged the man's prim mannerisms as a classic case of East Coast urban wuss. Although he was no more than 30, his hairline had receded over half of his scalp. He wore a three-piece silk suit worth at least $1,000 and a snow-white button-down shirt. A conservative red and gray striped tie pinched his soft white throat. The dandy opened an expansive-looking leather briefcase and extracted several sheafs of papers, all of them paper-clipped and clotted with yellow sticky notes that bore clear script. He wore a bulbous silver ring with a yellow stone, the word Harvard reflected from the metal. The dandy wouldn't look up, but studied his papers through horn-rimmed glasses before pulling a fancy pen from his inside pocket and jotting more notations on his yellow sticky notes.
I really do think the Cowboys will come back this year.
You're dreaming. This is the Redskins' year.
Mary's eyes narrowed as she examined the man to Keene's left, the white-haired bigwig. He appeared completely oblivious to his mild words.
Are the Fighting Whiteys going to make the playoffs, too?
Do you pay much attention to football, Mary?
That's my busy season, Wes.
Hunting season, I suppose?
Mary's eyes went to the bigwig. She almost snapped a reply when Jess Davis, the contract archaeologist on the project, entered the room with his usual lack of aplomb. Jess had the kind of absent-minded personality that made Mary wonder if a whirlwind hadn't been passing by at the moment of his birth. Her only ally for the coming ordeal, he wore blue jeans faded almost white, scuffed Vibram-soled hiking boots that puffed dust with each step, and a T-shirt emblazoned with the slogan, "Eat more buffalo! 50,000 Indians can't be wrong." He dropped a pack on the floor as he nodded around the room, that innocent smile on his blonde, bearded face. He pulled off his Australian bush hat, ruffled his dusty blonde hair, and plopped into the seat beside Mary. He started rummaging into his pack for something.
Let's see. Sorry, I'm a little late here. Just got these from the photo center. Thought we might need them.
At that, Jess dropped a couple of folders and a thick envelope on the table. Keene frowned expectantly. Next, Jess put his field notebook down next to his other displays. Finally, he pulled out a rectangular box. It said Nikon on the side, but sand, sun, and riding over sagebrush in one too many four-wheel drive vehicles had long since worn most of a marketing director's masterpiece away. Mary's gaze lingered on the box for a long moment, knowing what it contained. Perhaps their most compelling argument. When she glanced up, she noticed that the dandy's concentration had been jolted by Jess's arrival. He studied Jess with the same distasteful fascination he might have leveled at a scorpion crawling across the toe of one of his highly polished $400 Oxfords. Keene continued, smiling nervously.
Well, we're all here. I suppose most of us are old friends, but I'd like to introduce Hal Jacobs on my left here.
Keene gestured to the white-haired bigwig.
Hal is one of the first-level assistants to the Secretary of the Department of the Interior in Washington. We're fortunate that the Bureau sent him out to check on the project at just this time.
Just Wes's bad luck that I showed up.
Mary did not join in on the laughter.
And to Hal's left, we have Peter Preston. Hal needed a solicitor to check some of the papers, and Press happened to draw the short stick. Hal, Press, this is Jess Davis, principal investigator for Sayatasha Archaeological Services, the contractor conducting the mitigation of cultural resources for us on the Colpack Water Project.
Jacobs nodded, glancing evenly at Mary.
Oh, sorry. This is Mary Crowdog. She's the Native American monitor who works with Jess to make sure that Native concerns are given proper attention and respect. Mary is with the California Intertribal Heritage Coalition.
So, you're Indian?
I'm sorry. I guess I forgot to wear my free Leonard Peltier button today.
You're what?
Nothing. Inside joke. It's a pleasure to meet you both.
Well, let's get down to business, shall we?
Keene glanced around before smiling at Davis.
What have you found, Jess? And what does it mean? It must be pretty serious for you to shut down the dirt contractors. We weren't, expecting it. We thought the archaeology was all tied up.
I think we've got a paleo village site. Possibly intact, but at least in a state of good preservation. I was following the cat as it cut along the bottom of the slope in section 24. The right-of-way clips the point of one of the hills before dropping off to the Los Angeles Basin.
Right here.
Mel Adams, the project engineer, rolled out a USGS topographic map and pointed with a pen. A thin red line had been drawn diagonally across one section.
That's all sloughed off hillside there. Now what kind of an Indian would live on a slope like that?
Jess rubbed his hands together, oblivious to the fact that everybody was staring at him through slitted eyes.
No, that's just it. They didn't live on the slope. They lived on the hilltop.
So this is the trash they threw over the side.
Jack Riddler leaned forward, bracing his elbows on the table. Mary stared at him. How could Riddler have failed to read the report she had hand-delivered to him yesterday afternoon? She'd written it especially for this meeting, so he would have all the latest facts.
I think it's the whole village that slid down, Jack. Earthquake, I'd say. I had Roy Fielder out 2 days ago. You know, the geomorphologist. He agreed that the earthquake had probably happened just after they'd abandoned the village. The whole top of the ridge broke loose and slid down. After the slump, colluvium continued to erode down the slope, slowly covering the site. That's why we've got it. Just an accident of nature.
Excuse me.
Jacobs resettled himself.
How do you know all this?
Geomorphology, like I said. Here, look.
He pulled the photo envelope open, distributed the black and white prints to Keene, and kept a set for himself. Mary glanced over Jess's shoulder.
Hot off the presses. You can keep that set. Anyway, notice where the caterpillar is sitting. That's the pipeline right of way. We first cut charcoal and FCR at the...
FCR?
Fire-cracked rock. Rocks develop a hackling fracture when they've been heated in fire pits or are used for boiling stones.
Boiling stones?
The native peoples heated rocks and dropped them in water to boil stews, soups, teas, what have you.
That sounds impractical.
Mr. Jacobs, if you drop a 3-pound rock heated to 1,000 degrees into a hide bag filled with 10 pounds of water, it's pretty damn efficient. You see, the calories are released immediately, and it's...
Jess, I think Mr. Jacobs gets the picture.
Oh, okay.
Jess sat back. Keene smiled his plastic smile.
We were a little dismayed to hear that the project had been shut down. Is this site really that important, Jess?
Oh, absolutely.
Jess pointed to the next photograph.
This is the clincher. See the charcoal level they cut in the trench? We've got FCR and lithic debitage running...
Debbie who?
Debitage.
Mary cut Jess off before he bored the man to death with a blow-by-blow account of how to turn a chert nodule into a Clovis point.
The chips left over from stone tool manufacture. Making arrowheads.
Oh, right. Sure.
So you've got a cultural level?
Jack Riddler shifted in his chair.
You've already claimed that it slid down the mountain. You're talking about a lot of disturbance, aren't you? What makes you think any of this is in situ?
Mary addressed Hal Jacobs.
In context, in other words, the site's value isn't based only on the artifacts within it, but on the way the artifacts are related to each other. The most valuable archaeological site is one where they are left exactly the way they were when the people abandoned the area.
Look at this next photo, Jack.
Mary watched as Jess pulled out the picture. There, the man's bones lay partially exposed. The caterpillar had ripped away the left arm, splintered the ribs, and torn away the left innominate, but quick trowel work had uncovered the side of the skull, still intact.
Geologically speaking, a human skeleton is a fairly fragile thing. From the preliminary data recovered so far, it looks like we're not dealing with a great deal of turbation, disturbance of the soil. Again, another freak of preservation.
Jacobs delicately smoothed his white hair and leaned back in his chair.
Let me get this straight. An Indian village slid down the side of the mountain, and you think it's in good enough shape to dig, right?
Right!
Jacobs glanced down the table at Mel Adams, who had taken to staring at his yellow notepad.
Mel, what's our situation?
We've got to pour concrete on Valdez Point by next Friday. We're doing this with a just-in-time TQM approach to cut government waste. You know what the directives are in this project. Break a single link in the chain, and you've got a logistical disaster on your hands.
Jess hastily dug out the next photograph and laid it on the table.
This is the infant. Neonatal, we think.
Two burials?
So far. We could have a whole cemetery there.
What about the date? Jess, you said something about paleo.
Paleo refers to Paleo-Indian, Mr. Jacobs, people whom we know inhabited North America from 15,000 to about 8,000 years ago. They were big game hunters, mammoth, mastodon, California lion.
California lion?
You know about the La Brea tar pits. When humans arrived in California, it was a very different place. We think that people might have hunted out the large animals such as mammoths, giant sloths, cheetahs.
Yeah, they used to surf on mammoth tusks.
Only the BLM regulars laughed. Mary and Jess's eyes narrowed. Riddler scratched his gray beard.
Well, how do you know it's paleo? Did you get a diagnostic? Paleo Point? Faunal Association?
The baby is mostly intact. Look, see the brown thing on its chest?
Jess carefully opened the camera lens box, gently pulling back the tissue to expose a carved brown figurine that lay in the padding. Bits of dirt still clung to the side of the piece.
Ivory. Mammoth ivory. This was with the infant. Grave goods. What better paleo association do you want?
Could be intrusive.
What? Are you crazy? Even if it is, the figurine alone is reason enough to...
Davis, be real. So you've got a couple of burials in a site that slid down a mountain. That's why we let the monitoring stipulation ride on the testing and mitigation recommendations, just in case we miss something like this. Now, let's get the exposed materials recorded and be on our way.
Hang on, Jack. I think you've missed something in the translation. We may have a whole village here, a paleo village. And you know that coastal paleo is damn near gone, covered by 200 feet of Pacific Ocean.
The sea level rose over 280 feet in the last 15,000 years, Mr. Jacobs. We suspect that many of the most ancient sites in California are submerged, gone, for all practical purposes.
You've got FCR, charcoal, debitage, and bones, I admit, in a site that slid down a mountainside. I don't think that's worth holding up a $4 billion water diversion project.
The veins stood out in Jess's neck.
Look, Riddler, we've got to test the site. You can't just let this go. Testing will determine whether the strata are intact or not. I've looked at the catcut. I've got a preliminary profile drawn of the soil levels. They're intact, I swear to God. The data are there for any...
This site fell down a goddamn mountain, Jess.
The paleo surface is intact. Damn it, Jack, you can't skid out from under this one. We've got to test...
We've tested sites like this already, Jess. Three of them. On this same project, we've met our legal obligations.
Legal? According to 36 CFR 800, this site meets the criteria for nomination to the National Register of Historic Places. You can't just blow it off.
The lawyer was leafing through his papers, the white fingers as neat as the pages they turned. Up to that point, he'd paid little attention to the debate other than to glance curiously at the ivory figurine before returning to his documents. Jacobs had listened, no expression crossing his face, his mild eyes on Mary.
What's our bottom line, Mel?
If I don't have the concrete poured at Valdez Point by Friday, you're gonna see a cost overrun that'll make the B-2 bomber look like child's play.
Why? Why not just move farther east on the right-of-way and work there for a while? We can at least salvage some data in the meantime.
I wish I had that kind of flexibility, Miss Crow Dog, but I'm not budgeted for it. You see, building a pipeline's like building a house. Now let's say you have a problem with the electrical wiring. They sent you the wrong gauge of wire, so you can't put it in when you schedule it. You can't sheetrock the walls until all the wires are in, right? You can't finish the trim until the walls are all sheetrocked. You can't lay the carpet until the trim's in, and you can't move in the furniture until the carpet's laid. My problem is that I've got to move in the furniture, or more accurately, turn on the water by December 15th. I have a presidential promise hanging in the balance. Not to mention two irate senators and a truckload of congressmen landing on my butt. That's my problem. I've got to pour concrete or my pipe can't be placed and the president's promise is broken.
He's right. This is a political skyrocket. The administration has billed this as a jobs project for L.A. More water, less social tension, more incentive for business to come into the city. Jobs and bucks, folks. That's the bottom line.
Jess was glaring at Jack Riddler, and his calloused hands were working, as if he were strangling the BLM archaeologist in his imagination.
As a representative for the Native American community in California, let me clarify that we want this site tested. This is a burial ground. We know that much. I'm forced to agree with Jess. This site is very important. It contains at least two burials and is probably a Paleo-Indian campsite, one of the few we have this close to the coast. If we don't dig it, the bulldozers are going to go through and not only destroy what we can learn, but desecrate those graves.
Miss Crow Dog, we can sympathize, but we've got a great deal invested in this project.
Yes, a great deal. But then it's always been that way, hasn't it? Economic opportunity for the people, so long as they aren't native people. Mr. Jacobs, you've got to understand. I was present when the Bureau rerouted a power line around a white immigrant burial ground. It took a month. I watched a fortune spent to maintain a 17th century historic trail where Spanish priests walked. I do not begrudge the money being spent, but the Valdez Point site is far more important than either of those. This site is almost too rare to believe. Just because Paleo-Indian peoples didn't fight in the revolution against George III doesn't mean that their legacy isn't part of our national heritage as Americans.
You don't know that the site is intact. Look, we've already spent $350,000 on archaeological work for this project.
You can't find another $3,000 so we could at least test the site?
We don't have to test it, Jess. We've met our legal obligations. According to our solicitor's interpretation of the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, the intent of Executive Order 11593 and the 1980 amendments to the National Historic Preservation Act, as well as our programmatic memorandum of agreement...
The hell you have! I can repeat chapter and verse of the preservation laws, too. You can't blow this off, Jack. It's against the law.
Prez?
Jacobs looked at the dandy. Mary felt what Jess remained oblivious to. Power was shifting in the room. For the first time, the silk-suited dandy spoke.
The Bureau of Land Management is within its rights to terminate further work on this archaeological project, Mr. Davis.
He pushed a paper across the table. Jess picked it up, scowling. Mary glanced at it, noting the title. Her mouth tightened.
As you can see, that's a copy of the Programmatic Memorandum of Agreement, signed by authorized representatives of the Bureau of Land Management, the relevant State Historic Preservation Officers, and the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, to the effect that repeated archaeological testing is not necessary on sites considered to share similar values. Since the pipeline crosses several states, Arizona, Utah, and Nevada, as well as California, have signed off on the document.
How can we determine if sites share similar values unless we test them to find out? What idiot would negotiate such a PMOA?
If there had been problems with my district's formulation of the document, I'm sure that Arizona, Utah, or Nevada would have said something about it.
But we're talking about a Paleo-Indian village! We've identified nothing similar in the course of this project!
Come on, Jess. We found paleo sites in sections 6, 34...
They weren't village sites! There were no burials! They were broken paleo points surrounded by a few flakes on deflated ridgetops with no deposition!
Jess, we've tested sites at the bottom of slopes, too.
Yeah. Late prehistoric sites dating back 500 years. You're dumping apples and oranges in the same trash can, Jack. That's bad science.
Science isn't the issue, Jess. Compliance with the law is. And that's what our programmatic memorandum is designed to see to efficiently, with no time wasted.
Preston irritably peered over his horn-rimmed glasses and extended another sheet of paper.
This is a copy of the scope of work for the final phase of the project, Mr. Davis, the phase you are currently conducting. It states, and I quote, "All ground-disturbing activities will be monitored by a qualified archaeologist. Specifically, the excavation of the pipeline trench, right-of-way, and construction of associated pumping stations. Such monitoring is to identify and record any cultural resources which may have escaped detection during the initial cultural resources inventory for the project. Any such cultural resources located will be recorded prior to impact from pipeline construction, but no further work will be required on sites which are expected to yield redundant information about prehistoric or historic life ways. I have signatures from the SHPOs and the Advisory Council agreeing to that stipulation."
This isn't redundant information! This is a paleo village site! We can't...
You've uncovered no evidence to suggest that it's a village site, Jess. So you've got a couple of burials. Record the data, return the bodies to whoever requests them, and close up this phase of the project. Don't worry, Jess. You're going to be on the federal payroll for at least another month. Like we said, this is a jobs project. Your field crew will...
Listen, pot hunter! My people can find work anywhere, any day. I don't need...
Mary put a hand on Jess's forearm.
Let's get back to business, Jess. Sit down. Sit.
Reluctantly, Jess slumped back into his chair, but he continued to glare at Riddler with his teeth clenched. Preston, appearing indifferent now that he'd passed judgment, looked at the next of his documents, one of the mitigation reports prepared by Jess's firm. A rendering of the Pima tribe's sacred maze, depicting the twists and turns of life, had been used to ornament the title page. As if bored, Preston began working through the route with his expensive pen. Mary felt the inevitability crashing down on her. Nobody cared about protecting her people's heritage. But boy, oh boy, if this had been 10 feet of the Oregon Trail, the bureaucrats would have been hustling to protect it, rerouting the pipeline, dumping new money into the project. Mary turned to Keene.
Have you discussed this specific site with the SHPOs or the Advisory Council, Wes?
Keene gestured to Riddler.
I don't know. Have we?
Such measures are not necessary. The PMOA acknowledges that this district has the lead on the project and gives us the authority, based upon the PMOA guidelines, to determine when consultation is necessary. I say it isn't. Don't you agree, Wes?
Well, I don't know. Maybe we ought to...
My recommendation is to get on with this project.
Hey, you're the expert. If you don't think we need to consult...
There's another thing, too, Wes. I didn't want to bring it up because we're not certain yet, but...
What?
Well, from the map that Miss Crow Dog delivered to us yesterday, it appears that Jess's site may be on private land. Just this morning, I received a letter from the landowner, Mr. Black, stating that he waives any need to do further work on archaeological sites on his lands. So you see, no matter how you look at it, no further work is necessary. We've met our obligations under the law.
Preston looked up from his doodling and smiled at Mary.
Would you like a copy of the landowner waiver?
Yes, I would.
While Preston shuffled through his papers to find a copy, Mary watched Mel frown in confusion at his map, as if he was puzzled by the controversy over land status, too. Preston handed Mary a copy of the landowner's letter.
You're welcome to take this to litigation, of course.
What for? By the time I can talk to a lawyer, let alone find one who knows anything about cultural resources legislation, the site will be gone.
I'm sorry it didn't work out this time. We're a multiple-use agency. We have to balance the needs of many different interest groups. We can't show a preference for Native American perspectives over those of industry or of the people waiting for that water in the LA Basin.
Jess reached out, slowly running a finger down the mammoth ivory artifact, as though trying to imagine who had loved that tiny baby so much that they'd placed the figurine on its chest.
If I had any sense, I'd get out of this business.
He looked up.
Most of the good archaeologists have, you know. They saw the writing on the wall back in 84 when Operating Order Number 1 was implemented.
Please, Jess. We need data recovery from this site. Wes, Jack, at least let us take you out on the ground and show you the burials up close.
I'm sorry, Mary. I really wish I could help. I'm sure you understand the position I'm in. Hal's right. We can't give preference to Native American concerns here. Given the time crunch and the landowner's waiver, there's nothing more I can do.
The hot California sun burned out of a smog-ridden sky as Mary Crowdog stepped through the double-glass doors and placed her sunglasses on her nose. The skyscrapers downtown wavered eerily in the brown haze. Cars sped by, but the people hurrying along the street barely noticed. A line of BLM vehicles parked at the curb shielded them from a direct assault by the traffic. Jess looked as if he could chew cactus when he paused beside Mary, his pack over his shoulder.
Lost again.
Yes, lost again. Do you think they ever felt like this? The Paleo Indians? Did they know this futility, the despair and constant failure?
Oh, yeah. They were folks, Mary, just like us. Must have been tough on them when that last mammoth died. Some of them probably worked like hell to save their world. And, God forbid, they must have had spineless wimps like Keen, too. Plus a few conniving bastards like Riddler, Jacobs, and Preston. People stink.
First, they took our lives. Then our land. Then our culture, and finally, our dignity. Now, when some of us are trying desperately to get a piece of ourselves back by saving and studying our own prehistory, they're taking that from us, too.
Not all of us.
Yeah, Paleface. You're gonna write all this up for American antiquity. More archaeology for the benefit of other archaeologists? None of my people read that gibberish. What's the difference? It's all a white man's game, just like the landowner waiver. How much you think they paid Old Man Black to get him to sign that letter? Maybe they agreed to that land exchange he's been begging for.
If it's on private land.
Jess spat a brown streak of tobacco juice on the side of a BLM Bronco.
I need your grandmother to come down from Redding.
What for?
Maybe I've been hanging around you for too long. I stayed at the site late enough last night to pedestal that infant burial. I wrapped it in a burlap sack and toted it off to the lab. Yeah, okay. I stole federal property, or maybe private property. Let him come get me. Let me finish with the studies. Will your grandmother sing the kid's soul back to wherever it goes?
What made you do that?
Jess spat more brown insult on the door handle of a BLM truck.
Just a feeling, Mary. The adult skeleton, well, I guess he could take care of himself, as if he could stop a D9 cat. Hell, maybe he can, how do I know? Maybe he'll gum up the injectors or something. The infant, though, I don't know. I felt like I could hear it calling to me, asking for help. Just a feeling.
Next thing you'll be like the Navajo talking about witchcraft. They think you archaeologists are nuts anyway, purposely mucking around with corpse powder. Ah, but then what chindi would touch a white guy?
Even a skinwalker won't sink that low.
Maybe I ought to go hunt up a good Navajo witch. If I had a stash of corpse powder, I know just the guy I'd sprinkle it on. Jack would wish to hell he'd never written that stupid PMOA. I can't understand the SHPO's agreeing to give him sole discretion over determining when consultation is necessary on this project. It just doesn't figure. That's why they're there, to watchdog federal blundering.
Come on, I'll buy you a beer. Then I think I'll call the SHPOs and the Advisory Council. Maybe even Jonas Black. Just to check, you know?
Yeah, and after that you can try the Sierra Club, Friends of Brown Dogs and Gray Cats, and the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Dead People. You won't make any difference, Mary. Nobody cares what happens to a couple of dead Indians lying out in the desert.
Cheer up. If we can just get enough brown dogs on our side, we can violate every BLM tire in L.A.
The lodge had grown unbearably hot, stifling. Sun Chaser shoved weakly at the mound of hides that covered him. Sweat drenched his naked body, matting his long black hair to his temples and stinging his deep-set eyes. Cold trickles ran down his sides. He was so tall, 12 hands, that his feet rested uncomfortably against the opposite wall. The fire in the center of the dirt floor had been built up high enough that the flames leaped and crackled. Sunchaser studied them through fever-brilliant eyes, and the images wavered like a silvery mirage on the desert.
Good plume. Ant.
He managed to lift his head enough to look around. The lodge consisted of a pine pole frame covered with hides. It spread in a rectangle, 4 body lengths long and 1 wide. Good plume was gone. A nightmare sensation of helplessness possessed him. His mouth had gone as dry as the autumn grasses. Was it the fever? Or did he hear voices? Soft, muted words intermixed with the sputters of the fire. He let his head fall to the left. Sweat slipped over the skin of his face. Along the northern wall stood a row of 13 baked clay figurines. They peered at Sunchaser through sparkling dove snail shell eyes. The Steel's Light People. In their hands they held the timeless ebb and flow of divine power. Above, Old Man stood at the far end of the lodge, looking down upon the Steel's Light People. Like Mother Ocean, he was not one of the Steel's Light People, but was greater than all of them. Because of that, his figurine was twice the height of the others, 4 hands tall. His entire body had been painted pure white, but he wore a black weasel fur headdress sprinkled with quartz crystals that had been glued on with pine pitch. Sunchaser blinked wearily at the figurine. It seemed to be watching him intently.
Above, Old Man, your death gave life to the world.
In the beginning, Above, Old Man was all that existed. He was soft and shapeless like the clouds. He knew that to create the world, he would have to use part of himself. It took a great act of courage for him to open his veins and allow the blue blood to flow unheeded. But it poured out and turned into the blue waters of Mother Ocean, from which every other life form emerged. The froth on the mother's surface gave birth to the Steel's Light People. Father Sun, Dawn Child, Winter Boy, the Ice Ghosts, the Thunder Beings, Great White Giant, and all the others. Even Sister Earth and Brother Sky were born from the vast blue womb. First Condor, the biggest bird in the world, sprang to life soon thereafter, created from a ball of Sister Earth's clay. As Above, Old Man's blood drained away, he called to Condor. When Condor came, Above, Old Man said,
"Please, Condor, I am too weak. Let me give you the power to breathe life into the things I have created. You must hurry before the magic of creation dies. Otherwise, everything will just be bone and stone and water. It will never feel or think."
Condor had to fly very fast to cover the whole world before the magic was gone. While Condor did his duty, Above, Old Man grew weaker and weaker until he shrank to nothingness and died. The world lived because of him and Condor, but Above Old Man became cold and white and hard. Mother Ocean wept. She begged the other Steel's Light people to help her, and they made a net of seaweed and put Above Old Man in it. First Condor carried the net high into the sky, where Above Old Man was reborn as the moon. Sunchaser could feel the power of the Steel's Light people. It radiated from them like heat from flames. They made the rains come and winter go. As the children of Above Old Man, their prayers gave their father the strength to rise and cross the belly of Brother Sky every night. If the Steel's Light people ever failed to pray, the moon would rise no more.
Where is Good Plume, Steel's Light people? Do you know?
Sunchaser blinked to steady the wavering focus of his eyes and fought the drifting sensation that possessed him. With all of his strength, Sunchaser rolled to his right side so he could extend a trembling hand and pull the door flap back. His clammy fingers could barely keep their grip on the leather, but he managed to hang the flap on its peg. As he did so, the hide slipped off his chest, exposing it to the cold wind that swept Brushnut Village. He relished the shiver that shook him. The crisp scent of pine flooded his hot nostrils, and he inhaled deeply, seeking to fill his soul with the essence of the trees. Outside the lodge, the green pines gradually darkened into charcoal spears. They stood like dark sentinels against the translucent rays of pale pink light that shot across the sky. Sunchaser could see no clouds, but flakes of snow pirouetted through the trees and landed on the frozen ground. How long had he been ill? He couldn't even recall when he had retreated to his aunt's lodge to lie down. Where was she? Was the sickness still ravaging the village?
They need you, you fool. Good Plume is old. 80 summers. If she can't work all the healings by herself, it will kill her. Get up. Get up before it's too late and everyone that you care about is dead.
He tried to sit up, but fell back to his hides. The interior of the lodge swam around him in a blur of color. He felt sick to his stomach. Sunchaser had been born here in the mountains at Brushnut Village 25 summers ago. He knew and loved each person in the village. How many of them had died since he'd fallen ill? Good Plume's lodge nestled on the western side of the village, down the slope from the others.
Blessed spirits, what's happening? How? Good Plume?
Yes, it's me.
She pushed her walking stick through the doorway before she ducked through herself. Snow frosted the fur of her heavy buffalo coat and glistened in the gray straggles of hair that had come undone from her short braid. Her face had a skeletal angularity. Her sagging, wrinkled skin was the color of walnut oil. Sunchaser closed his eyes for a moment. Good Plume leaned her walking stick by the door and unhooked the door flap, letting it fall closed again.
Are you trying to kill yourself? Winter Boy is still out and about looking for souls to eat.
She bent down and covered Sunchaser with hides again, then went to the middle of the lodge, where she removed her coat and laid it by the fire to dry. Her thin arms stuck out from the sleeves of her doeskin dress. She walked over to a stump of wood close to the fire and sat down on it. Her hands shook as she held them out to the flames.
When I get warm, I'll heat up that raccoon soup we had for breakfast.
Tell me. I have to know. What's happening?
Oh, no, it will just worry you. You'll use up your strength.
Tell me.
Flint Pond died today. Everyone in the village is going mad trying to figure out who should be the next chief.
What about Flint Pond's son?
Little Elk died this morning.
And Little Elk's wife?
She's fine. So far. And we had better pray that Above Old Man keeps her that way. She's gone all over the village, cooking, cleaning, caring for the grieving.
Standing Moon is a good woman.
Good Plume nodded and lowered her hands to her lap. She rubbed her joints as though the old bones ached miserably. When she scrutinized Sunchaser, firelight flowed into her wrinkles, making her look 1,000 summers old.
People miss you. Everyone has been asking about you. Singing day and night, praying for the evil spirits to let you go. People need you. They think you're a better healer than I am.
Then they are all fools.
Ah, you are much loved, Sunchaser. If you up and die on them, they'll never forgive you.
I'm better, Good Plume. Stronger, really.
Oh, your fever is high, and the evil spirits have held you now for 3 days. If we can't pray the fever away tonight, I fear for you.
No, it's not that bad. I just... I'm so cold, Good Plume.
Sunchaser tugged weakly at his hides, pulling them up around his throat.
Aren't there any more hides?
Good Plume rose and went to a pile of folded skins in the rear of the lodge. She carried them back and spread them out over Sunchaser, then tenderly tucked the edges in around him. Still, he could not stop shivering.
I must pour some hot soup into you. Stay awake for me.
She crossed to the cooking tripod where the hide bag of soup hung and moved it closer to the hearth. Using 2 sticks, she picked up 4 of the small rocks that sat on the coals at the fire's edge and dropped them into the bag. A silver wreath encircled her face. She started searching for wooden bowls.
I must get well, Good Plume. The Mammoth Spirit Dance will start at Otterclan Village in 5 days.
The dance was held every moon at one of 3 villages, Brushnut, Whalebeard, or Otterclan. That way, people from up and down the coast, as well as from the mountain villages, wouldn't have far to go if they wanted to attend 3 or 4 dances a cycle. The dances brought great numbers of people together. Many of them walked for days to reach the village where the dance was being held, and Sunchaser tried very hard to attend each dance. But sometimes, like this moon, he just couldn't do it. Perhaps Oxbalm, leader of the Otter Clan, would delay the dance, waiting for Sunchaser? Occasionally it happened that way, but not often. And Oxbalm couldn't delay the dance for more than a week, because people would begin leaving.
Yes, that's right. And if you are not there, old Catstraw will lead the dance.
He's led it many times beforehand. He's not as bad as you think, but I've missed so many dances. I should be there. Though Catstraw tries very hard, he's just not...
Do you really believe he tries hard?
Good Plume walked back to the fire with 2 bowls and a wooden cup. Scowling, she dipped the cup and filled the bowls.
Have the mammoths grown more numerous with him leading the dances? No. None of them want to come back from the land of the dead if they think he'll be the dreamer to greet them. People wouldn't attend the dance either if they knew in advance that Catstraw would be dancing.
That's my fault. I should be out there walking the trails, telling people that it's the dance that's important. They think they need me there, but that is not...
Good Plume set a bowl of soup on the floor beside him.
Sunchaser, you try to help too many at once. No matter who asks to come to their village, you go. You use every shred of your power for others and save none for yourself.
I can't tell people that I won't come. Not when they are frightened or ill. Someone must give them hope.
Good Plume removed one of the deer hides from Sunchaser's chest, folded it, and tucked it beneath his head to prop him up. She tipped the bowl of warm soup to his lips.
It's all right to care about people, Sunchaser. But you must not let your concern disrupt your dreaming. If you do, in the end, even the people you have cared for the most deeply will hate you for it. Dreaming is the only way you can really help them, and they know it.
Sunchaser took a sip of the warm, delicately flavored soup and sank back against the hide pillow. He was shivering so violently that he barely managed to keep his mouth on the bowl long enough to get another swallow.
Perhaps.
Oh, you doubt me? Don't. I tell you the truth. You must stop giving so much of yourself to people. Pretty soon there won't be enough of you left to dream.
Sunchaser started to respond, but he heard voices again, faint, riding the wind like lost souls calling to him. He closed his eyes to listen better.
Sunchaser, where are you? Sunchaser, hurry!
It's coming.
A brilliant glow suffused the world around him. The dream lifted his soul and carried it away on wings of gold. He found himself crouching in a condor trap high on a mountain. Rocky cliffs jutted into the sky around him. He huddled down into a ball, but cold seeped from the frozen soil, penetrating his heavily fringed hide shirt and pants. All day long, snow flurries had intermittently frosted the peak. Above, Old Man must have been looking out for him. The thin white coating would help disguise his trap. The trap was a circle of rocks placed around a pit and covered with brush. 40 hands from the trap lay a dead bighorn, its magnificent horns catching the afternoon sunlight. Sunchaser had killed the sheep at dawn, dragged it down the mountain's rocky slope, and slit its belly open so that the internal organs lay in full sight. Grandmother Condor hunted warily, but only the downy underfeathers of Condor's wings could complete Sunchaser's ritual attire. He spied 2 tiny black dots gliding against the background of clouds, and he held his breath. He could just make out the white linings of their enormous wings. The condors descended slowly, cautiously, circling each other, cocking their red bald heads as their sharp eyes surveyed the conifer forest for danger. The huge female tucked her wings and sailed as straight as a well-cast dart to the dead sheep. The male alighted beside her, and together they hesitantly approached the exposed guts. The female tore into the liver, while the male pecked at the bloody lungs. Sunchaser pulled his bone dagger from his belt and readied himself. He waited patiently, twisting the fringe on his pant leg as he did a prayer of offering.
I see you, Condor. Hear my prayers. And clasping one another tight, holding one another fast, may we finish our roads together, keeping beauty before us always.
The Condor's 18-hand wingspan made taking off difficult, and when Condors ate, especially in cold weather, they gorged themselves. Flight would be even harder on a full stomach. After 2 fingers of time, both birds had slowed their consumption, stopping more often now to stare about and strut through the gutted mess they'd created. The male lifted his head and bent his neck back, perhaps to resettle his stomach. Soon they would fly away. Sunchaser burst from his hiding place. He leaped for the female's legs. The talons on her left foot ripped at his arms while she attacked the top of his head with her beak. Hot blood streamed down his face and dripped from his chin. He struck out with his dagger.
Please, Grandmother, give yourself to me so that mammoths may continue to live in our world.
He struck again and again. Warm stickiness coated his hand, and offal leaked from the bird's punctured gut. When the female at last toppled onto her back with her wings spread, Sunchaser reverently stroked her legs.
Thank you, Grandmother. I promise to use your feathers well and bury your body with many rare seashells and finely crafted dart points.
Suddenly, a breath condensed into a white cloud around the female's open beak. She blinked at Sunchaser, her eyes drowsy with death. Blood spattered her entire body, but the thick coating of red on her white underwings had come also from Sunchaser's torn flesh, a mixing of his blood and hers.
Forgive me, Grandmother.
He straightened and stood shivering in the glacial air. The male condor still circled above, his head cocked, alone, watching his mate's final moments. Sunchaser's soul ached. His eyes met and held the male's, and they shared their grief. Both understood that death was a fundamental part of their relationship. Condors survived on carrion, much of it either left by human hunters or from the humans themselves. Humans had to kill condors to obtain the sacred feathers they used for renewing and sanctifying the world. Human and condor constantly faced each other asking for life, and knowing that it came only through death.
I'll take good care of her, Grandfather. I promise you. She will fly to the land of the dead with my people singing her praises.
Sunchaser gazed down at the female. Her beak rested on the curved edge of her wing. She had stopped breathing.
Come, First Condor. Come and guard your child's soul until we sing her to the land of the dead.
He knelt and carefully folded Grandmother Condor's wings. The feathers felt soft and warm. He lashed her wings to her body with a thin yucca cord so she would be easier to carry, then braced himself. He lifted the heavy bird into his arms. Her head hung limply, the eyes half open, as he started down the mountain. That night, he camped in the lee of a thick stand of fir, sheltered from the worst of the storm. In the flickering firelight, she watched him, her bloody head slightly canted where he had carefully propped it. Sunchaser was exhausted to the point of collapse.
Your body will help the mammoths to live, Grandmother.
As he watched with half-lidded eyes, the condor stirred. A fiery burning traced its way through the wounds she had inflicted on his head and arms. He blinked, sure that he'd seen a shifting of firelight, a trick of the popping embers playing in the breeze. Power moved, loose in the darkness. Desperately, he fought sleep, drifting amidst the sounds of wind, fire, and night, hovering in a half-reality. A breath expanded the condor's lungs, and she lifted her head to stare at Sunchaser. A pale silver light burned in her eyes.
Now I understand your need for my body, human. You hunted me with honor. I will take you on a journey, a spirit journey far away. You shall see why you must pray day and night to keep the mammoths alive.
Grandmother Condor shook off the frail bonds he had wrapped her in and leaped from her resting place. She flapped low over the ground, her wingtips brushing the snow, then gained enough altitude to lift into the sky. She circled and swung back around over the jagged rocks and the swaying trees, her talons outstretched. Sunchaser was unable to flee. She sank those curved, bloody talons into the shoulders of his hide shirt and bore him upward through the gleaming layers of clouds. Bright fear pumped in time with Sunchaser's heart. She needed but to relax her grip, and he would fall and fall.
Look down, Sunchaser. What do you see?
Mountains gave way to green rolling plains, where huge piles of carcasses lay rotting in the sun. White bones gleamed, picked clean by predators. Not just mammoths lay there, but four-horned pronghorns, several kinds of horses, ground sloths, dire wolves, giant beavers, shrub oxen, saber-toothed cats, short-faced bears, lions. So many beautiful lions. Horror tightened Sunchaser's chest.
I don't understand, Grandmother. What is this? What am I seeing?
This is what the world will be like without mammoths, Sunchaser.
Filled with the dead and dying? Why?
Because everything is connected to everything else, Sunchaser.
Good Plume awakened when Sunchaser sobbed. She sat up in her robes and rubbed the sleep from her eyes. Wind buffeted the lodge, roaring with the strength of the thunder beings. The door hanging had come untied, and it napped like wings over Sunchaser's head. His hair bore a thick coating of pure white snow. Sunchaser tossed and turned, writhing as though trying to escape a pursuing monster. His hides had slipped down around his waist, baring his broad chest to the bitter wind. Good Plume rose and tiptoed over to him. Tears beaded on his lashes. She put her hand on his brow. His fever had broken, but he felt cold as ice.
Oh, you're going to be all right, Sun Chaser.
Plume rearranged the hides to cover him again.
Above, old man must have heard all those prayers your hundreds of followers have been sending up. And mine, too.
Before she retied the door flap, she stuck her head outside. Snow fell heavily, sheathing the forest in a thick, wintry blanket. Good Plume squinted when she caught movement in front of the lodge. A dog sat 10 hands away, covered with snow. He wagged his tail when she looked at him.
Oh, who are you? I know every dog in this village, and you're not one of them.
The dog rose and trotted forward.
Oh, are you cold? Well, no creature ought to be out on a night like this.
Good Plume held the flap back, and the dog ran inside. She secured the flap. When she turned, the dog lay curled at Sunchaser's side, his black muzzle propped on his paws. He was a pretty animal, all black except for the tan fur that encircled each of his eyes. The dog lifted his head and peered at Good Plume, and a tingle went up her spine.
Oh, you're not just a dog looking for shelter from the storm, are you? No, I don't think so. Did somebody send you here? Maybe one of the Steel's light people?
The dog put his head down again, but the feel of power that clung to him intensified. A spirit helper? Maybe. Sunchaser had quieted, though lines pinched around his deep-set eyes. In the scarlet glow of the dying fire, he looked old beyond his 25 summers.
Oh, but dreaming does that to a person. Never known a dreamer to stay young, and either body or soul. Spirits won't allow it.
Good Plume massaged her aching hip bones and hitched her way back to her robes. She stared at the wall paintings, and then her eyes sought the Steel's light people. They were watching her with a concentration that sent a shiver down her backbone.
I know you were worried, but I told you he was going to get well. It's all those prayers from his followers.
She could hear the figurines speaking softly to each other, their voices like murmurs of wind. The Thunder Being figurine stared at Good Plume with unnerving intensity.
Are you trying to speak to me?
The Thunder Being's obsidian bead mouth seemed to move in the wavering firelight. Good Plume cupped a hand to her ear.
The woman.
The Thunder Being whispered so low that she could barely hear the words.
Speak up. What, woman? What does she have to do with Sunchaser? What's the matter? Are you afraid of something? Well, when you're ready to tell me, I'll be eager to hear. Now go to sleep, all of you. We'll have a lot of work to do tomorrow. Healing and singing for the sick and dying.
She pulled her hides up over her cold ears and closed her eyes. The Steel's light people started talking again, muttering amongst themselves. She fell asleep to the sound of their soft murmurs drifting in and out of the storm's roar.
The woman's coming.
She catch
She's almost on her way.
Pray she does.
Rain fell, misty and cold, from the sodden gray sky. The chilling drops had soaked through Kestrel's antelope-hide dress as she scrambled up the steep slope through the turquoise sage. She glanced over her shoulder. In the soft, pearlescent gleam of twilight, she could see the two men coming fast, both of them tall and muscular. They ascended the slope in quick, measured steps, as though loping on dry ground rather than climbing through clay-slick mud. The warriors of her clan, the Bear Looks Back clan, had legendary abilities as runners. Kestrel hugged the bulk of her pregnant belly and desperately ran toward the red caprock ahead. In the distance, silver light penetrated the clouds. Campfires gleamed here and there among the villages of mound-shaped lodges. More fires flickered to life as the darkness increased, their twinkles twining through the hills like a necklace of amber beads. Around the villages, hundreds of ponds reflected the orange firelight.
Come on, run!
Tannin, Kestrel's brother-in-law, cleared the caprock behind her. His black eyes, unblinking but wild, were fixed on her like the eyes of a cougar stalking a rabbit. The tension in his thin face had incised deep lines across his forehead and drawn a web around his wide mouth. Soot and grease spotted the chest of his buckskin shirt, and mud mattered the fringes on his pant legs. In the dim half-light, the smears looked like clots of dried blood. Tannin sprinted up behind Kestrel and used the stone point on his dart to prod her in the shoulder.
Run!
Please! Please, Tannin!
If you don't move faster, I'll kill you here and now!
Kestrel dashed between two juniper. Locks of long black hair netted her oval face and tangled in her eyelashes. She hadn't the strength to brush them away. Small, frailly built, Kestrel knew that her strength had vanished long ago. Her chest burned as though a fire raged in her lungs. Tannin had kept her running for 2 days, so long that her feet had swollen hideously. Cottontail, the young warrior, trotted behind Tannin, his 16 summers old body bare to the waist and painted with blue, red, and white colors. In the rain, the designs had dissolved into a great purple smear.
Tannin, please, let me rest. Just for a moment, I can't keep this up.
Do you think I could show you mercy after the way you shamed my brother? Hurry!
He jabbed her shoulder harder, and the sharp point of his dart bit into her flesh. Kestrel turned pleadingly, walking backward. Her moccasin slipped perilously on the mud.
Tannin, listen to me. If you let me go, you know I will...
Let you go?
Tannin, I beg you, don't make me go back to him.
She extended her hands. Tannin had been her friend in the past. When her husband, Lambkill, beat her particularly badly, Tannin always sheltered her in his own lodge. His wife, Calling Crane, tended Kestrel's wounds, speaking gently to her as she washed the bloody fist cuts that covered Kestrel's face and chest.
He'll kill me. Tannin, you know he will. You've seen...
Ow! You deserve to die for what you've done. You and your filthy cousin.
He grabbed her by the fringed sleeve of her dress and flung her into a shambling trot across the wet sandstone.
I said run!
Kestrel staggered forward as fast as she could, trying not to trip in the scattered sage that snagged the hem of her dress.